It's the Iowa Art Showcase, our monthly performing arts program devoted to Iowa's not-for-profit arts and cultural organizations on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. Welcome to the Iowa Art Showcase. February has an astonishing array of wonderful arts events for the entire month, including Valentine's Day concerts. On the Iowa Art Showcase for February, we'll feature one of Iowa's best-kept secrets as we celebrate Black History Month with members from the African American Museum of Iowa. And we'll see how one amazing woman's dream, along with 50 years of hard work, transformed Iowa's musical landscape by creating a school of music and championing an innovative teaching technique. And we'll learn about a special series of concerts dedicated to the music and history of the Civil War, featuring Red Cedar Chamber, along with a noted Iowa historian and preservationist. And we'll be transported into Massenet's magical fairy tale opera Cinderella, being presented at Simpson College this month in Indianola. That's all ahead on Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase.
I really like for people to know that it's everybody's museum and that it's actually Iowa's museum, although in getting on the internet, you actually become the world's museum for African American history in Iowa. But the idea of teaching everyone some facet that perhaps they're interested in African American history, I think it goes a long ways toward racial reconciliation, and also companies find that we serve as a great resource for diversity and sensitivity training in the workforce. Those were things that we had not considered when we were contemplating being a museum, that is just such a pleasant surprise to see that we're acting as a resource and we serve the community in a way that is much higher, I think, in terms of the need in society. And it's just a delight to see people come through.
I love telling people that African American history is American history. You can't tell the story of the United States without it. You can't separate the two. And Iowa in particular has a really surprising and rich history. You know, I always tell the story of Alexander Clark, who was a Muscatine resident. He, right after the Civil War ended in 1867, tried to have his 12-year-old daughter Susan go to the school for white students. And when she was denied admission, he sued the school district. And Iowa's Supreme Court decided that Alexander Clark was right. There wasn't a legal precedence that was allowing segregated schools. And so in 1868, Iowa decided to legally integrate schools. Not every school district followed through with this. Quite a few of them wouldn't follow that law. But that law is on the books in Iowa almost 100 years before the 1954 Brown versus the Board of Education. We have a researcher working on it right now, and she has yet to find another state with a law integrating schools before us. Whether or not, you know, she'll find something, we're not entirely certain yet. But, you know, that Iowa did this so early on is just stupendous. And it just goes to show that there's so much history here to be shared.
The African American Museum of Iowa's Director of Education, Michelle Poe, and their Executive Director, Tom Moore, sharing about one of Iowa's best-kept secrets, the remarkable African American Museum of Iowa, located in Cedar Rapids. Michelle was a Michigan State grad. She discovered the museum at her job interview after she graduated with a history degree.
I was blown away with just the exhibits and the quality of the programming and everything they had to offer. I'd never been to Iowa before, had no idea what to expect. I've been at the museum for 3 years now, and I love it. It's a great place to be.
Tom was one of the original founders, and a museum wasn't even in the picture when they started.
Well, it's an interesting story because my background is totally different than what you would expect from someone who is a museum director. My background is accounting. I was 30 years at the Quick Roads Company as an accounting manager. I'm also a trustee at Mount Zion Missionary Baptist Church. And as a trustee, we had acquired some property that I wanted to see if we could develop into some activities for our youth and at the same time teach them some history. And so that's where the museum was born, at the church, out of an idea that we would put together some historical exhibits, just some homemade items that we would then teach our children some facts of national African American history. And it kind of evolved from that because as we got into actually using the building, we found we weren't going to be able to use the building for that. And by then, though, there was an interest with the committee that I had formed to start fundraising so that we could have our own facility. At that point, we developed our own organization. And so the African American Heritage Foundation of Iowa became our 501c3. And originally, I was thinking in terms of some missing elements to our young people's education. And I wasn't thinking any further than that at that time. And it evolved into trying to preserve the oral history as well as the artifacts that were quickly disappearing.
Well, let's talk about the museum. Now, this year is a big year for the museum. You're celebrating.
It's a big year for us. It'll be our 20th anniversary as an organization. And it'll be our 10th anniversary in the building that we're now in. The first 5 years, we were more doing organizational things and trying to find ourselves as to who we wanted to be and what we were going to do when we grew up. And so as we got into it, it was about 15 years ago that we hired our first executive director, Joe McGill. And from then, we started really thinking in terms of what museums actually do. And Joe taught us a little of the significance of what we were doing. We really didn't have a good idea of what we were doing. And so it's probably been about 15 years that we started doing programs, we started collecting artifacts, but we were fairly limited because we had no facility at that time to store the artifacts.
And then you had a facility, and then we had a flood. How did you guys recover from that?
We're just really grateful to the Iowa community who brought us back. We were able to move back into our building in December. We weren't near ready to open the doors, but at least we had a home base to operate from. And then the exhibit came later. I believe it was about September or so before we actually had the exhibit in 2009.
Well, tell us about the museum, and I'm coming to you because of Black History Month, but you do things the whole year through. So tell us about all the wonderful things that you have going.
Black History Month is really important for us because it's the time when people focus on African American history. But I like to tell everyone African American history is good year round. It doesn't just hold in February. So we just opened an exhibit in January called Western Africa Before the Boats. And this is all about what life was like in West Africa before the slave trade. So this has a great focus on the scenery. We have a rainforest mural, beautiful mural done by a local artist named Jeannie Reeves. We have a village scene, so you can see just the sophistication of the architecture and how people were interacting amongst each other. This is a Ghana and Ashanti village scene painted by another local artist named Karen Hoyt. There's clothing to try on, there's drums, there's all sorts of things to bring this region of our past to life. And we picked West Africa because as African Americans look at their past, any slaves who came to the United States typically were taken from the Western Africa region. We do other programs though besides our exhibits. We have an event in September called Journey to Freedom, and that is an Underground Railroad event where we sort of recreate parts of the Underground Railroad. You show up at Wiki Up Hill Outdoor Learning Center, which is in Toddville. You walk in and you are immediately put to work. There's an overseer who has people going through a field, whether they're running laps, whether they're moving wood, whether they're putting things together. And when he steps away, a plantation owner's daughter comes and helps you escape. And we take people through the trails of Wiki Up Hill where they learn different skills they would need to survive on the Underground Railroad, things like how to navigate using the stars, how to make a fire, how to get by, as well as some of the code words and common things you would need to know that are specific to the Underground Railroad. We have a large event in June called Juneteenth, and Juneteenth is a freedom celebration. The story with Juneteenth is that after the Civil War ended in Galveston, Texas, they did not tell the slaves there that they were free, that the Emancipation Proclamation and the end of the Civil War had freed them. They figured if they didn't tell them, they would keep working. And they eventually found out and had this great celebration on June the 19th. And so that's why we celebrate Juneteenth as a celebration of freedom. And that falls right around the same time, just before the 4th of July. So it really ties in with other freedom celebrations we have going on. We have a summer camp in the middle of the summer. This year is going to focus on Africa. I try to base that off of whatever exhibit we have going on. But the other two biggest things are with our 20th anniversary this year. We're going to have two different kinds of a birthday party to celebrate. We have an adult event on May 2nd, and that's going to be sort of an evening where we're going to celebrate where the museum has been, where it is now, and sort of look at where we're going to go to the future. And then on Saturday the 4th is a family day that's going to be the party. We've got cake, we've got ice cream, we're going to have African drummers, we're going to have puppets, we're going to have balloon animals, anything you can think of that would make a wonderful birthday party, we're going to try and make sure that's there. And this year we're going to be focusing on our History Makers Gala. And our gala is an evening event. It focuses on typically three, if not four, history makers in Iowa, African American women who have made a great impact on their community, whether that's through social service, whether that's through their business, just something that they've done so we can acknowledge the great things that are happening today, because history isn't just something in the past, it keeps going.
Well, the African American Museum has a very important mission to also help with education. And one of the things is these traveling trunks, which I think sound really interesting.
Traveling trunks are free for teachers and other youth leaders to borrow. They're a bin of things made to teach about whatever topic they're focused on. And so if you borrow our Egypt traveling trunk, we have information about hieroglyphics, we have videos, we have a puzzle you can put together about the pyramids. There are children's books, both fiction and nonfiction. And in each traveling trunk, we try to include lesson plans. So that way, if you're a teacher and you get this trunk, there's not only a list of everything that's in it and why it's important, so you can give yourself a crash course on the contents, but you can also figure out what you're going to do with your students while you have it.
What are some of the other things that you have available to families and to teachers?
We have traveling exhibits, which are sound complicated, but are quite easy actually to borrow and set up. You can get those for a couple weeks for just the cost of shipping them to you. And they're a banner. They come out of a small base and you pull it up. And those focus on topics from the civil rights movement to Buxton, Iowa, to African Americans in the military, anything you can think of. The Underground Railroad is one of our more popular ones, and those are free to borrow as well.
Michelle Poe, African American Museum of Iowa's Director of Education, and Tom Moore, the African American Museum of Iowa's Executive Director. For more information about the African American Museum of Iowa and their profusion of exhibits and special events, please visit their website at blackiowa.org. Just ahead, we'll share the history behind the Preussel School of Music in Iowa City. We'll talk about concerts commemorating Iowa's role in the Civil War and disclose details about performances of Massenet's Cinderella. You're listening to the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio. Welcome back to the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. With Valentine's Day around the corner, there are several opportunities to treat your significant other to special musical events. The Wartburg Community Symphony will present a concert featuring guest violinist Alexander Ambartsumian and his 14-year-old violinist son, Levin. Ambartsumian will perform Brooks' first violin concerto on February 9th on the Wartburg campus in Waverly. And the Heart of Iowa's Classical Guitar Society is presenting a Valentine Serenade concert on February 17th at 2 p.m. at Capitol Hill Lutheran Church in Des Moines.
We just started the school, and then we got a board. The school was just me, my husband, and Sonia Zeithamel. I mean, people thought we were crazy, but we knew that people would want these lessons. And when we opened the doors, people just flocked in, and it was so exciting.
Doris Preussel, founding director emerita and violin teacher at the Preussel School of Music. The Preussel School is a Suzuki school with over 700 pupils, established in 1975. Doris was an honors graduate of the Eastman School of Music. She was a violinist with the Washington National Symphony and the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra. She was also a member of the music faculties of Western Illinois University, the University of Northern Iowa, and Interlochen Arts Camp. This year, in honor of Doris Prusel's vision, leadership, and commitment to music education and the arts, the Prusel School of Music is dedicating their annual concert to celebrate Doris and her many musical contributions. The concert, which commemorates and celebrates 50 years of Doris's accomplishments, will be held on February 24th at 2 p.m. at the Iowa Memorial Union. Doris and one of her first Suzuki students, Anita Tucker, who serves as the concertmaster of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Symphony, joined us to share about how it all got started. As Doris claims, when the Suzuki method came along, she really got hooked, and the rest is history.
Suzuki was a violinist in Japan who studied in Germany, and after the war and all the devastation, he wanted to do something for the children, who were, of course, innocent children, and so he decided he would start teaching these little children how to play, and he actually went from house to house with one violin and gave lessons. Some of those children, by the way, one of them ended up teaching at Curtis. One of them ended up as a concert violinist. But the program grew in Japan, and in 1958, a graduate student came to Oberlin from Japan and wanted to show a film of some music students in his country. And there was a meeting at Oberlin of the American String Teachers Association, the Ohio branch. And out of all those teachers, only three stayed to watch this film after the meeting. And they were Clifford Cook, who was the violin teacher at Oberlin, and Bob Klotman, who eventually taught at Indiana, and John Kendall, who was teaching at a little college in Ohio. And of those three, they got excited about it, and John Kendall applied for a grant, and in 1959, he spent the summer in Japan, and he visited programs all over Japan and came back totally sold. When he went, he wasn't sure. He couldn't believe it, because this little film had hundreds of little children playing the Bach Double Concerto, which is something that we were pleased to have our high school students playing, unless they were a prodigy. And people that did play well younger were considered prodigies in this country. So that's the film that I happened to see on Captain Kangaroo in about 1961 or early 62. And my little children called me to watch TV. They were, you know, very interested. And I couldn't believe what I saw, the quality of the playing. They looked totally different than American students were looking in those days, because they were so free on their instrument, free with the bowing and everything. And I had been wondering how I was going to teach my own children how to play. My father taught me to play when I was 4 years old. He was a professional violinist. It turned out to be like the Suzuki method. I learned by ear, my father helping me along the way, and I listened to lots of music. And this seemed to be the thing that I could do with my own children. But I didn't want them to be unique. I wanted them to have some musical fellowship. So I thought, well, I'll start a little program and see how it goes. And it was just experimental. I really didn't know if I was doing the right thing. Teaching age four is a lot different than the teaching I had been doing. So in 1962, I got a hold of this film through John Kendall. When I first saw this film, I had no idea how to find out about this. And I combed musical magazines at the library and saw the name of John Kendall. And he was wonderful. He shared everything he had learned by seeing things in Japan, and told me about his first book that was just coming out in publication. And I'd got the film, and there was an article in the paper, Pearl West. I said, Pearl, at West Music, if you let us show this film, we'll order all our violins from you. And so we showed this film, and there were about 40 people that came for this showing. And after the showing, there were 12 children, 11 including my son Bill, that signed up. And this is where Anita comes in.
Did you see the film, and did you know right away that you wanted to take the violin?
I did see the film. My parents had seen the article in the paper about this film that was going to be shown and that Doris was starting a Suzuki program, and I had expressed some interest in music at that point, so they took me to see this film. And the family story is that afterwards, when she made the announcement that anybody who's interested can come up to be measured for their instrument, that I just announced that it was time to go get me measured. So I went up and got measured for my instrument, and that was the beginning of that.
Do you remember any of these early lessons at all?
Oh, yes, I do remember. I have a few very vivid memories of some of the early lessons with other kids and some of the early exercises and pieces.
Well, Doris, tell us a little bit more about this story then. You had 12 students, and I know you were teaching in the basement of your home.
Right. We built a new home, and we moved in on Christmas Eve of 1962. And the downstairs studio that I had specifically had designed so I could teach little groups in there was not yet finished. And so the month of January, they were finishing up our house. And so we started on, I believe it was February 2nd, 1963, which was a Saturday. And that was the first lesson. And Anita and Billy and a little boy named Robbie Lash, whose father was Christopher Lash in the university, we divided these 12 kids into about three little groups, and they came together for their lessons. And they learned for 3 months, and it was astounding. I couldn't believe the way this method worked, even with me just kind of experimenting and learning along the way. And in May, we did a demonstration, and they played some of the early pieces that you learn. And then I got 50 students and a waiting list. So that's the way it just blossomed. And then word of mouth, and every parent wanted lessons. My phone would ring, people would be knocking at the door. And that's the way it kept up until finally in 1975, we opened the Prussell School of Music so we could hire more teachers and then expand to other instruments as well. But along the way, we also started our own little string orchestra. The Suzuki method was very maligned in the beginning. Anything from Japan was not looked on very kindly. And also, the idea of learning by ear and not learning to read music first was very controversial. So I always knew that the reading was very important, just like when a child is learning their language, they learn to speak and they learn what the words mean. And then they learn what they look like. And the same thing has to be done with music. And with me having a background as an orchestra player, I really wanted to have these kids have a rich orchestral experience as well. As early as 1967, when the kids were only 3-4 years into the program, we started a string orchestra, and we traveled a lot through Iowa and even Omaha, and gave concerts both of Suzuki playing by memory and the orchestra. And every program in Iowa that eventually started was a result of our program, except one in Sioux City. So we were really busy proselytizing this method. In 1967, Ruth Carouse, who was a professor at Iowa Wesleyan in Mount Pleasant, asked me to help her write a Title III grant so that she could start Suzuki programs in 4 southern Iowa communities. And I did that, and it was a wonderful grant. The big problem was finding trained teachers. But in 1969, Suzuki came and did a workshop for teachers at Iowa Wesleyan. And our students were the demonstration group, and we also gave a concert at that. And so that was really eye-opening for many people in Iowa. In the meantime, things were growing around the country. I was so busy teaching all these students and 3 young children, I wasn't aware until about 73 when they started a Suzuki Institute up at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. And from that time on, it really grew. But we were really pioneers. So this coming February 2nd, being the 50 years from that first lesson, is really a very touching date for me, because when I started, I didn't have any idea what was going to happen with this. But when you work with these children and you see what can happen, and I mean, before that, people started at 8 or 9 years, and that's too late. And since then, of course, science has shown so many things about how you should learn music before you are six, and how good it is for brain development and everything else, not to mention it's a happy thing to be involved in for children. I mean, like Anita, what were you just telling me? When you practiced, it was just like what?
Well, it was just one more thing. My mother tells me that I would just pick it up and play it on my own instead of going and playing with some of my toys. And I liked to choose that to do. In coming at it from the other end, I was just a kid who wanted to play music and enjoyed the classes and just took it for granted, really.
Well, you were my student until you went to Indiana University.
That's true. I studied with Doris from that first class all the way through high school. But really, she guided me through all the way up until I went to college. I think one thing that is a happy event for me is just that because it was so natural that we would go and play for all these different people, performing was never something separate or like a big scary event that it can be for some people. And I think I was very fortunate that for me, a recital was just a natural opportunity to play and share music with people. So I think that was a huge benefit to me, that it was just one more thing to do and one more way to play.
And that's what Suzuki had in mind. It should just be another form of enjoyment. He was a very giving person, and he taught almost, well, to a couple of years before he died, and he was 99 when he died. Bill and I are going back to Japan in March. There's going to be an international Suzuki conference, and we'll be teaching at that. And, of course, we spent maybe 12 different trips to Japan with our involvement with the International Association and teaching at conferences. But when I was on the international board, I think we had like Suzuki in 39 countries, and it keeps growing. So with our concert that's coming up in February, it's really the only way that people can see what actually happens with Suzuki Method. So every year we have an annual string concert. It used to be in Hampshire, but right now it's in the Memorial Union. And it shows the gamut. It shows the oldest students and the youngest students and what the growth is and how well-mannered and how the children are able to care for themselves. They have stage presence. They really learn a lot besides music. Our school has a motto maybe that Suzuki is life training. It's not just music training, and it has definitely turned out to be that.
Tell us about some of your involvement nationally and internationally.
Well, I became president of the Suzuki Association of the Americas in 82, and in 83, there was a wonderful celebration at Oberlin, 25th anniversary of the showing of this film that started it all. I was president at the time, so I got to go to Oberlin and give the welcoming speech to the Japanese that came, and it was quite a wonderful day. I served for 12 years as the head of the teacher training program for Suzuki, because there became a need to train teachers as more and more people wanted this. And so the SAA became very active as the group that supervises all the teacher training in the country. And then at one of the conferences in Japan, Suzuki wanted to start an international association. So I was on the founding board of that for 12 years.
Well, you also were very instrumental in developing the piano accompaniments and then also the viola book.
Oh, that's another side of my life. I always was interested in composing and arranging, even as a child. And Suzuki chose me to write the viola school for the Suzuki Method because he only had it for violin, and in Japan they only had violin and piano and flute. But in America there's such a need for viola and string bass, and So I worked on that. I started it in 1976, and I'm just finished volume 9, which is the last volume, and it's at the printers right now. And that's like a big load off my mind. I sort of had a goal to finish that before I was 80, and I turned 80 in December, so that's done. So that day of starting my first Suzuki lesson marked something new for my life, and it really, all four children became professional musicians, not because we wanted them to, but because they saw how much love we had for it, and they're all loving their life, and it's going on to the next generation. So it was meaningful for me as my family, as well as the Iowa City community. But mostly it's remembering all these people that have gone through. And, you know, it's not like I want to be remembered. I think what I really want people to know is how wonderful this is for their children.
Doris Prusel, founding director emerita and violin teacher at the Prusel School of Music, along with one of her first violin pupils, Anita Tucker, concertmaster of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Symphony. The Prusel School of Music is dedicating their annual concert to celebrate Doris and her many musical contributions. The concert, which celebrates 50 years of Doris's accomplishments, will be held on February 24th at 2 p.m. at the Iowa Memorial Union in Iowa City. To find out more about the Prusel School of Music, about the concert on the 24th of February, and about Doris Prusel's amazing contributions to music education and arts in our state, please go to their website at prusel.org. Don't go away. Just ahead, Iowa history sleuth Michael Zaz and guitarist and musicologist John Dowdle fill us in on the Red Cedar Chamber Music's series of concerts this month called 7 Score and 10, along with an exciting glimpse with guest stage director Crystal Manich and Simpson's assistant professor of music and Larson chair of opera, Bernard McDonald, as they reveal the fairy tale background for the opera currently being performed by Simpson students, Massenet's gem, Cinderella. You're listening to the Iowa Arts Showcase on Iowa Public Radio.
The Civil War made Iowa. We were still such a young state. The Civil War is what brought us together as a unified group. And we need to be reminded of that, I think, because Iowa people were tough people. And one of the parts that Iowa played in the Civil War was anyone of any age could join the Army from Iowa. One of my grandfathers joined the Union Army at age 52. Which was nothing, because there was a man right down the road from Ainsworth that joined the Union Army at age 80. Iowa provided more people power in the Civil War for the size of the state than any other state. We had over 13,000 that died, which is more people than live in some counties in Iowa now. And we had people that were in favor of the South. Well, before the Civil War, Jefferson Davis was an Iowan. He built the first mill in Iowa. Robert E. Lee mapped the eastern coast of Iowa. He mapped the Mississippi River. He lived in Iowa. John Breckinridge, who was Secretary of War for the Confederacy, was an attorney from Burlington. So we had not only a lot of people from the Union, all the top people from the Confederacy also had Iowa ties. And when John and Jan talked about the Civil War, I had just come in possession of almost 200 letters from the same family from the Civil War, plus other Civil War things. So it just seemed like a good chance to go through those letters and glean some things that would be going with the music that Red Cedar was going to be presenting.
Historian, preservationist, and retired educator Michael Zaz, whose family has lived in the Ainsworth vicinity since 1808. Michael was talking about Iowa's role in the Civil War and about a series of February concerts to be performed by Red Cedar Chamber Music, commemorating the sesquicentennial of the Civil War. Welcome back to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase. I'm Jacqueline Hallblum. The Red Cedar Chamber Music was initially founded in 1997 by flutist and executive director Jan Boland and guitarist, musicologist, composer, and arranger John Dowdle. To find out more about this incredible chamber ensemble based in Marion, please visit their website at redcedar.org. This month's Red Cedar series of Civil War concerts, called 7 Score and 10, will feature Jan Boland on wooden flute, John Dowdle on gut string guitar, Michael Zaw speaking and reading from Civil War papers and correspondence, and soprano Carla Gettle performing at the Bruce Moore concert. The main stage concert will be on February 23rd at Bruce Moore Mansion in Cedar Rapids. John Dowdle and Michael Zaws continue talking about the American Civil War and Iowa's key role in it.
The Civil War had many names. It was called the War of Northern Aggression by the South. It was obviously called the Civil War, the War Between the States. But one of the most important words, I think, was the Cruel War. It was a cruel war because people were basically killing people that they really had a kinship with. They just had a difference of opinion, or they were stuck on opposite sides, and that was their job, was to try to kill one another. It was family against family. And so some of the songs reflect a lot of the things that happened in the Civil War. One is called Ellsworth's Funeral March, and Ellsworth was a young man who actually helped Lincoln get elected in Illinois and then followed him to Washington. And when Virginia seceded from the Union and they hoisted a Confederate flag that Lincoln could see from the White House, Ellsworth said, I'm going to go get that. So he got troops together, went across the Potomac and got it. It was on the top of a hotel or a tavern. On his way down, the proprietor of the institution shot and killed him. And so Septimus Winter, who is an iconic composer of that time, who actually wrote a lot of little tunes and collected music together in things that people would read in their home for chamber music, he wrote this tune, Ellsworth's Funeral March. And Ellsworth became an icon to the Union troops and actually helped them enlist a lot of people at the beginning of the war. They said, remember Ellsworth? And his name was actually used interchangeably in that Ellsworth body lies a-moldering in the grave, like John Brown's body. Then there's another one called Sherman's March to the Sea by Samuel Byers. He actually wrote the words. He was an Iowan. I think he moved to Iowa when he was 14, and then like 6 years later, he enlisted. He wound up in a prison camp, and he couldn't sleep. So he wrote this song about Sherman's march to the sea, where he basically just destroyed everything in front of him. And the story goes that he shared it with a bunch of friends around the campfire. One of those friends was a Lieutenant Rockwell, which I think is pretty interesting, the name Rockwell, in relationship to Cedar Rapids. And Lieutenant Rockwell, without Byers knowing about it, wrote music to it, and then the Glee Club sang it 2 nights later, and then it was smuggled out in a wooden leg by one of the troops who was being exchanged and became a hit. And that's how we call it Sherman's March to the Sea, because this Iowa soldier wrote those words.
What I thought was interesting, that a lot of these pieces that you picked, they were used by both sides. They would change the words or do something, mm-hmm. but the music was used for both of them.
Their one particular example is this tune by George Root. And George Root was kind of the Northern composer. He turned out so many songs. I believe Lincoln said he was responsible in large part for the victory of the North, because he wrote so many inspirational songs. One was called Just Before the Battle, Mother. Just before the battle, Mother, I was thinking most of you. And then the Southern troops got a hold of that, and they changed it slightly and did a parody on it. And the parody was, Just Before the Battle, Mother, I was drinking Mountain Dew. And then the chorus of that particular one is, the Northern version was, Farewell, Mother, you may never hold me to your breast again, but I know that you'll remember if I'm slain in battle then. And then the Southern version was, Farewell, Mother, you will never see my name among the slain, for I will skedaddle and I'll come home again. So it was that kind of, they made fun of the Northern troops. And so that was the kind of use of songs you had all through that time. And then there are other songs like The Governor's Gray Schottische, which was written by Maria J. Jones, who was actually the daughter of a senator from Dubuque. And that one deals with an interesting twist. We think of the Union in blue and the Southern troops in gray. Well, they had all sorts of colors. And here was the governor's grays, which were a special regiment assigned to the Iowa governor. So the uniforms that the troops wore were by no means, well, uniform. They were all over the map. So it was sometimes hard to tell who the heck you were fighting, actually. I guess I'll just add that one of the important roles that music played in the Civil War was not just to make the troops ready for battle. Every unit had a band, and I believe it was General Lee said that he couldn't imagine the war without music because that's really helped the troops get energized. Often it was the music that changed the tide of battle. They'd play a certain song and the troops would get revved up and they'd go in. But there was also the drummer boy and the fife. Often they led the battle charge. And also the fife was a way of signaling. I mean, they couldn't have people texting or using cell phones. And the fife was a very shrill instrument. So if it was time to go see the doctor, there'd be a fife call. If there was time for meal, there'd be a fife call for that. If it was time to retreat or advance, there'd be a fife call. And so Jan will be bringing a fife along, and she'll be demonstrating some of those fife calls and some of the functional role that music played in the war. There's just so much to talk about, so many interesting songs. And we're going to be doing three rural outreach concerts prior to the main concert. The main concert is actually on February 23rd, Saturday at 8 o'clock at Bruce Moore. And that concert's going to have something special we don't have at any other concert. And that is Carla Gettle, soprano, is going to be singing several tunes, including the When This Cruel War Is Over, Tramp, 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 which was written by George Root. It was also called The Prisoner's Hope because it was about being in a prison camp. And she'll sing that parody on Just Before the Battle, Mother. So we'll have Carla, we'll have the music with the flute and guitar, we'll have Michael reading from the Civil War letters. So it's really going to be a little bit more like a performance art piece or almost a theater kind of setting.
Red Cedar Chambers guitarist, musicologist, composer, and arranger John Dowdle, along with historian, preservationist, and retired educator Michael Zaz. For more details on Red Cedar Chamber Music's 7-score and 10 series of sesquicentennial Civil War concerts and the Bruce Moore concert, please visit their website at redcedar.org. You're listening to the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio. Has a bounty of opera performances this month. The University of Iowa's Opera Theater is presenting two operas, Bernstein's Trouble in Tahiti and Menotti's Amelia Goes to the Ball. That's tonight at 8 p.m. and again tomorrow afternoon at 2 at the Englert Theater in downtown Iowa City. Opera Iowa is performing The Elixir of Love on February 11th at the Pella Opera House. The University of Northern Iowa's Opera Theater is presenting an opera gala on February 23rd at 7:30 p.m. at UNI's Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center. And Opera Simpson is performing Massenet's Cinderella February 15th through the 17th on the Simpson campus in Indianola. Simpson's Assistant Professor of Music and Larson Chair of Opera, Dr. Bernard McDonald, is the music director and says this production holds two firsts for Opera Simpson. The first time they've had a guest stage director, and the first time they perform Cinderella. The guest stage director is Crystal Manage.
Although the story is primarily a fairy tale, there are real moments of intimacy and maturity as well. And I think that there's something in all the characters that anyone can relate to. And it's the music that really creates everything from darkness, dark humor, dark themes to lightness, and also to the magical themes of the piece that can be enjoyed, I think, by everyone. And especially my take is that all aspects of anyone of any age can really enjoy this opera, but it does have a weight and a maturity to it that I think people don't necessarily think about when they think of the story of Cinderella.
Simpson's guest director, Crystal Manich. Crystal got hooked on opera early.
I discovered opera when I was about 15 years old through a Maria Callas recording of Tosca. I had really been into musicals before that, but listening to opera for the first time, it was my first realization of how well drama and music could really work together in such a heightened way with those opening scarpia chords at the beginning of the opera. So I was hooked from then on, and I started just listening to opera as much as possible. And I knew I wanted to be involved in the theater. At the time, I thought I wanted to be an actress, and then I decided to study directing as an undergraduate in the School of Drama at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, which is my hometown. And throughout my time there, I knew that I wanted to be involved in opera, so I tried to steer my 4 years there, plus my final year, which was a grad program in my fifth year, towards thinking about working in opera as a professional director and possibly later on to maybe run my own company someday. So that's how I discovered opera.
Crystal Manich and Simpson's assistant professor of music, Bernard McDonald's opera paths crossed in Pittsburgh. Bernard shares why he selected Massenet's Cinderella for Simpson's February opera production, and both Crystal and Bernard talk about Massenet's Cinderella.
Eventually, I settled on Massenet's Cinderella, or Cendrillon, and as soon as I did, I realized this beautiful French opera, to the best of my knowledge, has never been performed in Iowa. It was very rarely performed anywhere in Middle America, and it's relatively unknown, but it affords tremendous opportunities for lots of women, especially mezzo-sopranos, or the kind of somewhere the voice between soprano and mezzo-soprano for the Cinderella. The prince is played by, it's a pants role for a young woman, a soprano or a mezzo-soprano. And we had some baritones for whom it was a great vehicle. And as I started to look at the score, I realized a few things. First of all, it's a tremendous challenge, but it's an opportunity to create magic through theatre, and I knew that Crystal would be a great match for that. So the route by which we got there is quite complex, actually, but what an amazing opportunity. Well, of course, everyone is familiar with the story of Cinderella. Massenet's version is notable for several things. It's got great wit and variety in creating the magic of the fairy world, the kind of innocent awakening of young love between the two protagonists is created by very beautiful, rather sensuous music. There's also music that's redolent of the classical French ballet, influences perhaps even going back to Rameau and Lully, and certainly 19th century French ballet. And then you get bits of magic that might be perhaps like Mendelssohn's Midsummer Night's Dream, except with a French accent. And you also hear, especially when it comes to the kind of love between the prince and Cinderella, you hear something that shows that Massenet knew his Wagner as well, and Massenet visited Bayreuth and probably played in some capacity music of Wagner at various times in his life. Experienced listeners will also hear the influence of Debussy, the kind of musical language that's very much the fin de siècle, the end of the 19th century in France. So I think Massenet creates a piece with its own musical syntax, which draws from various musical influences. So it's a Gallic take on a universal story, and I think our audience will be quite taken by how extraordinarily beautiful a lot of it is. And Massenet is not a hugely well-known composer, perhaps, except among opera buffs. He really was the leading French composer in the late 19th century. He was born in 1842, a child prodigy. He attended the Paris Conservatoire, aged 11, and he studied composition with Ambroise Thomas, He won the Prix de Rome in 1863. He was very prolific. He started writing operas very successfully in the 1860s. And Massenet, a little bit like other composers of his generation, tended to fall out of fashion after the First World War. But what's happened in the past maybe 20 years is that composers like Massenet perhaps undergoing a reassessment now that we are sufficiently distanced from the period after the First World War. Another thing, he truly did enjoy commercial success. His operas were popular, and Cendrillon enjoyed 50 performances after it opened at Paris at the Opera Comique. It was produced all over Europe and came to the United States. So the piece enjoyed great success, but it has more or less stayed on the periphery of the repertory throughout the 20th century and into the 21st.
Crystal, tell us, you are teaching acting classes for Simpson students as well as directing this. So what are you bringing to this marvelous operatic performance of Simpson College students?
My aim for the acting classes is to get these young singers more into their body. And I've been really interested in the last few years working with specifically the Michael Chekhov technique into trying to apply that, which is a very physical acting technique, and trying to get that to connect to the voice of the singer. And the way to do that is just to try to teach about the different centers of the body, which can therefore create emotion, an emotional response within the body, and therefore be expressed through the voice. So that is what my approach is for the acting classes. And in rehearsal, I always try to apply the same thing, just to get more physically into their bodies so that the expression of the character is not just vocal. Because if it's only vocal, then the visual does suffer, because opera is an all-encompassing dramatic form that requires both the aural and the visual. I've decided to take the approach of setting it in the 19th century because of course, of the music having been composed just before the turn of the 20th century. But the silhouette of the costumes of the period most interested me from the 19th century. The set design, which we're doing in collaboration with Steve McLean at Simpson College, my idea from the beginning to him was, I want to create a dollhouse of sorts. If we're dealing with a story that is primarily a fairy tale, I want the set to be almost like a dollhouse, where everything on the inside of it moves, and we don't hide how it moves. We show the audience what is transforming within the overall space. So we have only one intermission, even though there are four acts. So we're totally implementing this idea of a fireplace turning around and becoming a tree in the forest. We have things that fly. We have characters who bring on and off very specific furniture and props. So we're showing, in a way, we're exploiting the magic to its fullest. And the magic is not just what's in the music, but it's also in how I'm approaching the entire show, that the entire show and the entire story is magical in some way. So in the first act, we don't meet Cinderella until about 15 minutes in, and we're presented with her father as the first main character presented, and he immediately delivers an aria, or a monologue as it were, lamenting about how he wishes he had never left his quiet home in the country to marry this woman that he really can't stand because of how cruel she is to his daughter. It's made very clear that Cinderella's mother has been long dead. We're never told how or why. And I think it's implied, and this is what I'm certainly exploiting in the staging, is that it's implied in the text, especially, that he is strapped to this marriage because of the wife's financial situation and his lack of finances. So that is something that we're exploiting there. And so he unfortunately goes along with a lot of the things that his wife makes Cinderella do, such as working in the house and whatnot. But there does come a point where we see the father finally, in the third act, completely want to give up this life, no matter what the cost, because of how much his daughter has suffered. So I think the father-daughter relationship is really essential, and the lack of a true mother is one of the most important aspects of the piece. And that's why the fairy godmother is so important in the story, because she is a mother of sorts to Cinderella, and she makes her dreams come true, and she appears and gives her a dress and a carriage to go to the ball, where she is able to meet her Prince Charming. And of course, we have fantastic elements that are very familiar in the story of Cinderella, which she loses her glass slipper when she leaves at the stroke of midnight from the ball. And of course, the prince is searching for the girl who will fit that slipper. But Act 3 has a fantastic feature where the two lovers find themselves lost in the woods and they can't see each other and they can only hear each other. And the fairy godmother grants the prince's wish to see Cinderella, and the flowers and branches disappear and they behold each other for the first time since they saw each other at the ball. There are fantastic elements to the story that are included in this opera, but there are also elements in the opera that do not necessarily stem from the source material that most of us are familiar with. So I think it's a fantastic interpretation of Cinderella, and it's not what you think. It's unique. And the music is really fantastic for any stage director to sink her teeth into.
Simpson's guest stage director is Crystal Manage, and Simpson's assistant professor of music and Larson Chair of Opera, Dr. Bernard McDonald, is the music director. For more details on this performance, please check out the website at events.simpson.edu. This is the Iowa Arts Showcase on Iowa Public Radio. Today's Iowa Arts Showcase broadcast is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Program thanks for this program goes to Michelle Poe, Tom Moore, Doris Prusel, Anita Tucker, John Dowdle, Michael Zah, Crystal Manich, and Bernard McDonald. Production thanks goes to Iowa Public Radio's production assistant, Tony Daner, and KCCK's news director and producer, George Dorman. Production thanks for this show also goes to Iowa Public Radio's Eric Jordan, Jason Burns, and Garrett Van Leeuwen. Program research was provided by Uta Brandenburg, Jan Boland, Phil Moss, Bernard McDonald, and student assistant Mallory Sullivan. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. Thanks for joining us. For more information on Iowa Public Radio's programming schedule and Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase, please visit our website at iowapublicradio.org.